So, what happened? I said after a mile. Tell me. She told me a pretty straightforward story. They'd started work on my alibi late Friday evening, she and Finley. A dark squad room, a couple of desk lights on, pads of paper, cups of coffee, telephone books, the two of them cradling phones and chewing pencils, low voices, patient inquiries, a scene I'd been in myself a thousand times. They'd called Tampa and Atlanta, and by midnight they'd gotten hold of a passenger from my bus and the ticket clerk at the Tampa depot. Both of them remembered me. Then they got the bus driver as well. He confirmed he'd stopped at the Margrave Cloverleaf to let me out, 8 o'clock Friday morning. By midnight, my alibi was looking rock solid, just like I'd said it would be. Saturday morning, a long fax was in from the Pentagon about my service record. 13 years of my life reduced to a few curling fax pages. It felt like somebody else's life now, but it backed my story. Finley had been impressed by it. Then my prints came back from the FBI database. They'd been matched by the tireless computer at 2:30 in the morning. U.S. Army, printed on induction, 13 years ago. My alibi was solid, and my background checked out.
Finley was satisfied, Roscoe told me. You are who you say you are, and midnight Thursday you were over 400 miles away. That was nailed down. He called the medical examiner again just in case he had a new opinion on the time of death. But no, midnight was still about right.
I shook my head. Finley was one very cautious guy. What about the dead guy? I said. Did you run his prints again? She concentrated on passing a farm truck, the first vehicle we'd seen in a quarter hour. Then she looked across and nodded.
Finley told me you wanted me to, she said. Why?
They came back too quickly for a negative result, I said.
Too quickly?
She said. You told me there was a pyramid system, right? I said. The top 10, then the top 100, then the top 1,000, all the way down, right? She nodded again. So take me as an example, I said. I'm in the database, but I'm pretty low down the pyramid. You just said it took 14 hours to get down to me, right?
Right. She said. I sent your prints in about 12:30 at lunchtime, and they were matched at 2:30 in the morning.
Okay, I said. 14 hours. So if it takes 14 hours to reach nearly to the bottom of the pyramid, it's got to take more than 14 hours to get all the way down to the bottom. That's logical, right?
Right,
she said. But what happened with this dead guy? I said. The body was found at 8 o'clock, so the prints went in when? 8:30, earliest. But Baker was already telling me there was no match on file when they were talking to me at 2:30. I remember the time because I was looking at the clock. That's only 6 hours. If it took 14 hours to find out that I'm in there, how could it take just 6 hours to say the dead guy's not in there?
God, she said. You're right. Baker must have screwed up. Finley took the prints and Baker sent them. He must have screwed up the scan. You gotta be careful or it doesn't transmit clearly. If the scan's not clear, the database tries to decipher it, then it comes back as unreadable. Baker must have thought that meant a null result. The codes are similar. Anyway, I sent them again first thing. We'll know soon enough.
We drove on east, and Roscoe told me she'd pushed Finley to get me out of Warburton right away yesterday afternoon. Finley had grunted and agreed, but there was a problem. They'd had to wait until today, because yesterday afternoon Warburton had been just about shut down. They had told Finley there had been some trouble in a bathroom. One convict was dead, one had lost an eye, and a full-scale riot had started. Black and white gangs at war. I just sat there next to Roscoe and watched the horizon reeling in. I'd killed one guy and blinded another. Now I'd have to confront my feelings. But I didn't feel much at all. Nothing, in fact. No guilt, no remorse, none at all. I felt like I'd chased two roaches around that bathroom and stomped on them. but at least a roach is a rational, reasonable, evolved sort of a creature. Those Aryans in that bathroom had been worse than vermin. I'd kicked one of them in the throat and he had suffocated on his smashed larynx. Well, tough shit. He started it, right? Attacking me was like pushing open a forbidden door. What waited on the other side was his problem, his risk. If he didn't like it, he shouldn't have pushed open the damn door. I shrugged and forgot about it, looked over at Roscoe. Thank you, I said. I mean it. You worked hard to help me out. She waved away my thanks with a blush and a small gesture and just drove on. I was starting to like her a lot, but probably not enough to stop me getting the hell out of Georgia as soon as I could. Maybe I might just stay an hour or two and then get her to drive me to a bus depot somewhere. I want to take you to lunch, I said. Kind of a thank you thing. She thought about it for a quarter mile and then smiled across at me. Okay, she said. She jinked the right turn onto the county road and accelerated south toward Margrave, drove past Eno's shiny new place, and headed down to town. Chapter 9. I got her to duck in at the station house and bring me out the property bag with my money in it. Then we drove on, and she dropped me in the center of Margrave, and I arranged to meet her up at the station house in a couple of hours. I stood on the sidewalk in the fierce Sunday morning heat and waved her off. I felt a whole lot better. I was back in motion. I was going to check out the blind Blake story, then take Roscoe to lunch, then get the hell out of Georgia and never come back. So I spent a while wandering around, looking at the town, doing the things I should have been doing on Friday afternoon. There wasn't really much to the place. The old county road ran straight through north to south, and for about four blocks it was labeled Main Street. Those four blocks had small stores and offices facing each other across the width of the road, separated by little service alleys which ran around to the back of the buildings. I saw a small grocery, a barber shop, an outfitter's, a doctor's office, a lawyer's office, and a dentist's office. In back of the commercial buildings was parkland with white picket fences and ornamental trees. On the street, the stores and offices had awnings over wide sidewalks. There were benches set on the sidewalks, but they were empty. The whole place was deserted. Sunday morning, miles from anywhere. Main Street ran north, straight as a die, past a few hundred yards of more parkland up to the station house and the firehouse, and a half mile farther on than that was Eno's Diner. A few miles beyond Eno's was the turn west out to Warburton, where the prison was. North of that junction, there was nothing on the county road until you reached the warehouses and the highway Cloverleaf, 14 empty miles from where I stood. On the south edge of town, I could see a little village green with a bronze statue and a residential street running away to the west. I strolled down there and saw a discreet green sign which read, Beckman Drive, Hubbles Street. I couldn't see any real distance down it because pretty much straight away it looped left and right around a wide grass square with a big white wooden church set on it. The church was ringed by cherry trees and the lawn was circled by cars with clean, quiet paint parked in neat lines. I could just about make out the growl of the organ and the sound of the people singing. The statue on the village green was of a guy called Caspar Teal, who'd done something or other about 100 years ago. More or less opposite Beckman Drive on the other side of the green was another residential street running east with a convenience store standing alone on the corner. And that was it. Not much of a town. Not much going on. Took me less than 30 minutes to look over everything the place had to offer. But it was the most immaculate town I had ever seen. It was amazing. Every single building was either brand new or recently refurbished. The roads were smooth as glass, and the sidewalks were flat and clean. No potholes, no cracks, no heave. The little offices and stores looked like they got repainted every week. The lawns and the plantings and the trees were clipped to perfection. The bronze statue of old Casper Teal looked like somebody licked it clean every morning. The paint on the church was so bright it hurt my eyes. Flags flew everywhere, sparkling white and glowing red and blue in the sun. The whole place was so tidy it could make you nervous to walk around in case you left a dirty footprint somewhere. The convenience store on the southeastern corner was selling the sort of stuff that gave it a good enough excuse to be open on a Sunday morning. Open, but not busy. There was nobody there except the guy behind the register. But he had coffee. I sat up at the little counter and ordered a big mug and bought a Sunday newspaper. The president was still on the front page. Now he was in California. He was explaining to defense contractors why their gravy train was grinding to a halt after 50 glorious years. The aftershock from his Pensacola announcement about the Coast Guard was still rumbling on. Their boats were returning to their harbors on Saturday night. They wouldn't go out again without new funding. The paper's editorial guys were all stirred up about it. I stopped reading and glanced up when I heard the door open. A woman came in. She took a stool at the opposite end of the counter. She was older than me, maybe 40. Dark hair, very slender, expensively dressed in black. She had very pale skin, so pale it was almost luminous. She moved with a kind of nervous tension. I could see tendons like slim ropes in her wrists. I could see some kind of an appalling strain in her face. The counter guy slid over to her, and she ordered coffee in a voice so quiet I could barely hear it, even though she was pretty close by, and it was a silent room. She didn't stay long. She got through half her coffee, watching the window all the time. Then a big black pickup truck pulled up outside, and she shivered. It was a brand new truck, and obviously it had never hauled anything worth hauling. I caught a glimpse of the driver as he leaned over inside to spring the door. He was a tough-looking guy. Pretty tall, broad shoulders and a thick neck. Black hair. Black hair all over long, knotted arms. Maybe 30 years old. The pale woman slid off her stool like a ghost and stood up. Swallowed once. As she opened the shop door, I heard the burble of a big motor idling. The woman got into the truck, but it didn't move away. Just sat there at the curb. I swiveled on my stool to face the counter guy. "Who is that?" I asked him. The guy looked at me like I was from another planet.
"Well, that's Mrs. Kleiner," he said. "You don't know the Kleiners?"
"I heard about them," I said. "I'm a stranger in town. Kleiner owns the warehouses up near the highway, right?"
"Right," he said. "And a whole lot more besides. Big deal round here, Mr. Kleiner."
"He is," I said.
"Sure," the guy said. "You heard about the foundation?"
I shook my head, finished my coffee, and pushed the mug over for a refill.
"Kleiner set up the Kleiner Foundation," the guy said. "Benefits the town in a lot of ways. Came here 5 years ago, been like Christmas ever since."
I nodded. "Is Mrs. Kleiner okay?" I asked him. He shook his head as he filled my mug.
"She's a sick woman," he said. "Very sick. Very pale, right? Sort of wan. A very sick woman. Could be tuberculosis. I've seen tuberculosis do that to folks. She used to be a fine-looking woman, but now she looks like something grown in a closet, right? A very sick woman, that's for damn sure."
"Who's the guy in the truck?" I said.
"Stepson," he said. "Kleiner's kid by his first wife. Mrs. Kleiner's his second. I've heard she don't get along so good with the kid."
He gave me the sort of nod that terminates casual conversations, moved away to wipe off some kind of a chromium machine behind the other end of the counter. The black pickup was still waiting outside. I agreed with the guy that the woman looked like something grown in a closet. She looked like some kind of a rare orchid, starved of light and sustenance. But I didn't agree with him that she looked sick. I didn't think she had tuberculosis. I thought she was suffering from something else, something I'd seen once or twice before. I thought she was suffering from sheer terror. Terror of what? I didn't know. Terror of what? I didn't want to know. Not my problem. I stood up and dropped a five on the counter. The guy made change, all in coins. He had no dollar bills. The pickup was still there, stationary at the curb. The driver was leaning up, chest against the wheel, looking sideways across his stepmother, staring in straight at me. There was a mirror opposite me behind the counter. I looked exactly like a guy who'd been on an all-night bus and then spent 2 days in jail. I figured I needed to get cleaned up before I took Roscoe to lunch. The counter guy saw me figuring.
"Try the barber shop," he said.
"On a Sunday?" I said. The guy shrugged.
"They're always in there," he said. "Never exactly closed. Never exactly open, either."
I nodded and pushed out through the door. I saw a small crowd of people coming out of the church and chatting on the lawns and getting into their cars. The rest of the town was still deserted, but the black pickup was still at the curb, right outside the convenience store. The driver was still staring at me.